And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This month marks the 60th anniversary, the launch of the world's first artificial satellite, Sputnik 1, back in 1957.
Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket. Here, an artist's conception of how the feat was accomplished. A three-stage rocket. Number one, the booster in the class of an intercontinental missile. Its weight estimated at 50 tons. The smaller second stage took over at 5,000 miles an hour and carried on to the highest point reached. 500 miles up, the artificial moon is boosted to a speed counterbalancing the pull of gravity and released. You are hearing the actual signals transmitted by the Earth-circling satellite. One of the great scientific feats of the age.
Little universal newsreel audio from 1957, the launch of Sputnik. It started the space race between the U.S. and former Soviet Union. Joining us this half hour to talk about the significance of that event and his own many decades of involvement in the U.S. space program, which dates practically back to the launch of Sputnik, Don Gurnett, University of Iowa Physics and Astronomy professor. Welcome back to our studio.
Well, yes, glad to come back and talk to you.
Let's talk about that launch. Take us back to 1957. My colleague Ben Stanton and I thought a little bit earlier, how many people have this in their living memory? We're alive, but also more than that, have this in a living memory. It's only something like maybe something over 10% of Americans today have that event in their living memory. Take us back to that time.
Well, it's a vivid memory for me because in high school I'd read about the possibility of an artificial satellite, and I studied, even made rockets in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was knew that such a thing was possible. But it was a huge surprise when the Russians did it.
A huge surprise for the U.S. population, but also for scientists?
Well, I wasn't a scientist then. I was a high school student. Well, just into college, I had arrived at the University of Iowa to go into electrical engineering on roughly September, somewhere around the 20th. And about 10 days later, Sputnik 1 was launched.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just so impressed. And they gave the times in the newspaper when you could go out in the evening after sundown and watch it go over. And I remember doing that almost every opportunity when it wasn't cloudy.
This newsreel audio we heard here, I think they call it an artificial moon, but the size of it, this is from the New Yorker article on this anniversary, a shiny sphere of aluminum, magnesium, and titanium, 23 inches in diameter, weighing about as much as an adult man. It was equipped with the barest essentials of spaceflight, a radio transmitter, a battery, and a fan to keep it cool. So there's not much there.
There's not much there. In fact, in a scientific sense, there wasn't much there. All it had on board was a temperature sensor, and it just measured the temperature of the vehicle, the Sputnik,
mm-hmm.
and not the surrounding atmosphere.
And it broadcast what data back?
It broadcast the temperature back, and it gave kind of a beep, beep, beep. And it was in a ham radio band, so that meant that, you know, amateur radio people, kind of like myself, but I don't really count myself as an official ham radio guy, could listen to it. And a lot of people did. I did not. I was strictly visual. You could see it going overhead. Very small, very hard to see, but moving very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right at the time they predicted.
So you got this thing moving across the nighttime sky, launched by the Soviet Union. We're in the middle of the Cold War.
We're in the middle of the Cold War.
This is a time, the 1950s, people are building bomb shelters in their houses.
That's right. That's right.
To survive a thermonuclear war.
And that's what I think impressed most Americans. Actually, the real impact was it looked like suddenly we're behind the Soviet Union in technology. They had already exploded an atomic bomb and a hydrogen bomb. And now all of a sudden they had an object, a Soviet object going overhead. It meant they had a missile capable of sending a nuclear weapon to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just one aspect. The other aspect is suddenly, you know, we thought after World War II, we thought of our nation as being, you know, technologically superior.
We were the preeminent nation, of course.
We were the preeminent, and all of a sudden it was quite clear we were not.
So how did the Soviets manage this feat before the U.S.?
Well, the Soviets have very smart scientists. I give them credit to this day for that. They had very sharp people, and they were ambitious about doing that. They knew it was possible. My understanding is they did not utilize German scientists after the war.
As we did,
Von Braun. Mm-hmm. There was an article in the Scientific American a few years ago about that. They really had difficult relations with the Germans and did not treat them well after the war.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a Russian indigenous development. And it became apparent that the United States somehow had to catch up. And that started a very strong push in what is now called STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And you could say that I'm part of that, actually, because a lot of money was poured into engineering in this country. And the University of Iowa benefited greatly from that, as I'll get into in just a minute.
Mm-hmm. So you could feel, as a young man, an undergraduate interested in this area, physics and astronomy, Sputnik is launched. It happens to be your field of interest. There's this national conversation, this fear of the Soviets being preeminent in this area, overtaking the United States here. So there's this conversation, and then the funding comes for education, for research.
The funding comes, right.
Yeah.
However, I was right at the leading edge of that. And let me tell you, because in high school I worked with I was involved in a model airplane club in Cedar Rapids, and about half the members were adults from Collins Radio, and they were working on radio control models. And I got very involved in that. And these were with tubes. It's not like today where you just plug things together. You had to make these things yourself.
Right. This is not like my era, the early 70s when I was a boy. We could buy Estes rocket kits. This is not that.
No, the rockets I built in high school were made out of charcoal, sulfur, and saltpeter. And my dad had a lathe, and I used to make the nozzles for the rockets and pipes for the tubes that they went in. You know, you'd call them pipe bombs now.
Right. I was thinking post 9/11, I don't know how far you would get when people were looking in your garage.
They probably wouldn't. I was asked by a druggist what I was doing with that saltpeter once. And I just said, oh, I'm making rockets. And he said, have fun. Something like that. Actually, I gave that up in about, I'd say, when I was a senior in high school, because one exploded. And I decided that was the last time I would do that. So anyway, Van Allen was working on Explorer 1 here.
Let's remind our audience, James Van Allen died in 2006. He was instrumental in establishing the field of magnetospheric research. In fact, the Earth's Van Allen belts are named after him. He also helped with the first successful of a U.S. satellite, didn't he?
Oh, that's correct. That's what I'm about to describe here.
Yeah.
He had worked with Von Braun, who you mentioned earlier, who was a German rocket scientist, after the war working on V-2s. Van Allen was interested in cosmic rays, and he would put a Geiger tube, which can detect cosmic rays, on V-2s, captured V-2s after the war, and they would shoot them up into the atmosphere to measure the cosmic ray intensity as a function of altitude. So now, actually, Von Braun wanted to launch a satellite. In fact, he had a rocket, a Redstone rocket, which was an intermediate-range ballistic missile. That's where he was working at Redstone Arsenal down in Huntsville. And he wanted to use this rocket to try to launch a satellite, an improved version of it. But Eisenhower would not let him launch it, for fear of antagonizing the Soviet Union.
Hmm.
Well, it's obvious the Soviet Union didn't have a similar point of view when they went and launched Sputnik.
Yep.
So after Sputnik, Eisenhower empowered von Braun to go ahead and develop this more advanced Redstone for the purpose of launching a satellite. In fact, von Braun had one already developed, hidden down in the basement, so the story goes. And he and Van Allen and another, the head of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Bill Pickering, proceeded to develop what was later called Explorer 1. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory did the spacecraft. Von Braun did the rocket, and Van Allen did the Geiger tube and associated instrumentation. By the way, there were only two people involved here at the University of Iowa at that point, Van Allen and George Ludwig, who was an electrical engineering student, as I was, in the engineering department here.
Wow.
And they got this all working, and on February 1st, it was successfully launched. So in a certain sense, we caught up with the Soviet Union a little bit.
And a few months after Sputnik.
That was about 4 months after Sputnik. And it was, of course, a huge success, widely advertised, especially because Van Allen discovered a radiation belt. This was totally unexpected. He was thinking that it would be the Geiger tube would be just detecting cosmic rays, but in fact there was this extremely intense radiation belt around the Earth that's now called the Van Allen radiation belt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because of his fame, I just couldn't resist going over to his office and asking if he needed some help.
And?
I needed a job. I wanted a summer job.
You remember actually walking into James Van Allen's
office? Oh, very clearly.
Tell me about that first encounter.
Yeah, well, he wasn't there. But his secretary, Agnes McLaughlin, who I later got to know, you know, almost the rest of her life, was there. And she asked me to write down what my qualifications were. And so I said, engineering student, specialist in radio-controlled electronics. Which, from the model airplane stuff, I knew a lot about. I worked in a hobby shop. I sold the stuff. I helped people fix, you know, make the stuff work. And about a month later, I got a handwritten note from him, hiring him in my group. And this was a time of tremendous expansion. You know, the space race just started. The University of Iowa was right in the middle of it. And the center of space research was here at the University of Iowa. So there was this huge expansion, and I was a key player in that expansion.
Don Gurnett is my guest this half hour. If you've just joined us, University of Iowa physics and astronomy professor, decades of work at the University of Iowa on some really key projects. We've had him on our program before, but we're recalling the 60th anniversary of the world's first artificial satellite, Sputnik, back in 1967. A few months after that, the U.S.'s first satellite started circling the globe as well. Tell us, Don, a little bit about, we only have less than 10 minutes now, but some of the highlights of your career working with James Van Allen and so many different projects that we have in our space history.
Well, in those very early days, I was basically in electrical engineering, doing electronics design. And I'd say one of the key things that I worked on almost from the beginning was the conversion from analog electronics to digital.
Mm-hmm.
The early explorers, like Explorer 1, were basically analog. They would transmit the information by tones. If you listen to the signal, it would kind of go dee, 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 like that, each tone representing a certain voltage. And it was very difficult to decode. That was the problem with it. And it was actually another person, Brian O'Brien, a very young assistant professor hired about the same time I was hired, suggested that we try digital. Now, digital then didn't mean what it does now, because there were no computers. There were no computers in our campus.
Digital meaning either on or off, one
or
zero.
Zeros or ones. So mm-hmm. I designed a data system that transmitted zeros and ones. And we flew that on the first spacecraft built entirely by a university. It was called Engine One. I apologize for that name, but it was a Navy-funded project, and that was the name we ended up with. In fact, we built a whole series of engine satellites, and I was the project engineer on several of them. And so we really developed the digital world here. Mm-hmm. And we started, we eventually bought a computer, an IBM computer for analyzing the data. And that was way back in the beginning. And of course, since then, it's expanded tremendously. We've flown a total number of projects here of 69. I just counted them up.
That you've been involved in?
No. That's the department with 69. I've been involved in 41 of them.
That's a good chunk.
Oh, yeah, a pretty big chunk. Yeah, doing the electronics design, eventually leading the projects. I became a professor here. I went to Stanford for a short time and then was hired back. And this is my 52nd year as a professor at the University of Iowa.
Amazing. Before we leave, you brought some sounds along with you. I don't know if we have time to hear all of them, but we have this Earth Whistler.
Yeah,
is that the one we want to hear?
Yeah, that's what got me interested in becoming a physicist, actually. Mm-hmm. There was a guy showed up here, Roger Gallet was his name, and he played these radio sounds that we heard on the ground. They were called whistlers. And I decided to go out and build a radio receiver. No proposal or anything like that. Just build a radio receiver, and I asked Van Allen if we can put it on the spacecraft. That was Engine 3. And he said, oh, go ahead. And so I integrated into the spacecraft, and whistlers are produced by lightning. And as soon as we turned the transmitter on, it was just amazing. The sounds I'm going to play now are the first sounds detected by Engine 3 as we were going over a thunderstorm. And each lightning stroke is producing a whistler.
This is a rocket going over a lightning storm.
It's a spacecraft. It's in orbit, right.
Okay, it's in orbit going over a lightning storm, and it's hearing these whistlers.
Yeah, that's because the high frequencies travel faster than the lower frequencies, and they get to the spacecraft sooner. So you get a whistling tone dropping in frequency. Why don't you play it and people can
let know.
And those sounds converted me to being a physicist because I wanted to understand exactly how they're produced and that sort of thing. We also heard another amazing thing, which is now called Dawn Chorus. And we now know that these signals are produced by the Van Allen radiation belt electrons, mm-hmm. which was completely unknown at that time what were causing them. And why don't you go ahead and play that?
Let's play the chorus then.
It's pretty amazing.
Sounds like it's straight out of a sci-fi film.
Yeah, you don't, you know, it's as though you're sitting in a quiet room like this, and the molecules up in the corner of the room get together and start whistling at you. You don't expect that, do you?
No,
well, we call it a plasma in a radiation belt. We now know that that can happen. In fact, I teach courses explaining how those instabilities work.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit, with your long view, over 50 years working in space research based here at the University of Iowa, where are we now? Where are we going? What do you see under this administration or the future of what we're doing?
Yeah, well, let me comment on how much we've achieved in 60 years. I mean, just think about that. We have communication satellites. We have weather satellites. We've gone to every planet in the solar system. I had an instrument on Voyager 1 and 2, and we've now reached, with Voyager 1, we've reached interstellar space, region between the stars. We did that about 3 years ago after a flight time of 36 years. So, you know, we've done a lot. So what do we do next? Well, we need to put a spacecraft in orbit around Uranus. We've already done that at Jupiter and Saturn, the most recent one being Cassini at Saturn, which just crashed into Saturn a couple of weeks ago. We need to go to Neptune, put a spacecraft in orbit around Neptune. And I'd really like to see an interstellar probe, one that gets us out into interstellar space farther than we're going to get with Voyager 1.
Do we have the STEM support, the support for STEM and the young people's minds, as you were, to support such a vision?
Well, we at the University of Iowa certainly do. We've developed in the department, I'd say space physics is probably a third of the department. I mean, it's a major player in the physics department here. And I'm looking forward to a great future here. I don't know how much I'll be a part of it. I'm almost 78 now. But I think we got a lot of potential things to study in space, and that we'll continue to do that.
Mm-hmm. In the last few months, what's the most Cassini, the most exciting space news that you've been keeping up on, or other space?
Well, Cassini, exciting space news. We just crashed into Saturn. I argued that they should just keep it in orbit, but they wanted to make sure they didn't spread some bugs around in some of the other moons.
All right. Don Gurnett, we have to go, but I could talk with you all day with your view of space research. Longtime space scientist at the University of Iowa, Professor Don Gurnett, University of Iowa Physics and Astronomy Professor. Thank you so much for coming into our studio, giving us a perspective on the Sputnik launch, and for bringing those fascinating sounds.
Good. Thank you.
Okay, coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about DACA. Of course, that's in the news. The Trump administration just sent a sweeping list of immigration policy priorities to Congress. We'll hear about that tomorrow on the program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.